Det är onsdagen den 15 juli och du lyssnar på Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. And today we'll have this podcast in English because I'm joined now by James Lindsay, who's an author and of 6 books and the forthcoming book Cynical Theories: How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender and Identity and Why This Harms Everybody. That's a really mouthful of a subtitle, but I've just read the book and it's really great, and it will be out the 25th of August. So I'm very pleased to have you with me, James.
I'm glad to be here. And that is a mouthful of a subtitle. We really had a hard time coming up with the subtitle for this so that it could cover. It's very difficult to talk about this subject without people thinking that you're evil or a lunatic. So we had to kind of cover all the bases at once. It was very unfortunate. It was a long process to choose that very long subtitle.
I like the subtitle to the subtitle and why this harms everybody. you really know that you're like, it's really awful, folks. So we added a subtitle to the subtitle. But I just wanted to, like, on the book cover, you've crossed out critical theory. So cynical theories is a play with critical theories, and you renamed the critical theories to cynical theories, and it's very obvious if you see the front cover. But could you, like, just to retrace the steps? I think when I told people I was going to interview you, they didn't know who you were, in Sweden at least. And then I mentioned, but perhaps you've heard about the Grievance Studies affair. Oh, yeah, the Grievance Studies. Okay, so he's one of those guys. So could you just, like, I know that you've been asked to do this many times, but could you just, like, recapitulate what the Grievance Studies was and... You did that together with Peter Boghossian and Helen Pluckrose.
We actually, the three of us, I was writing. I was kind of at the vertex of a V-shaped writing arrangement. I wrote with Peter and I wrote with Helen, but Helen and Peter did not write with each other. Mm. And at the time in, say, 2015 and 16, we were, and even 14 really, we were observing that there was a problem with we were calling and just earmarking as the gender studies literature. We had been watching people get accused of being sexist for reasons that didn't seem to make sense. We were told that sexism and misogyny were systems and that we didn't understand them properly. And being the kind of dorks that we are, we were not comfortable being told that we didn't understand a thing properly. So we went to look into it. Started to read the relevant scholarship and noticed that it's really kind of out there. Peter and I initially started to, all three of us independently, I should say, not to skip ahead, tried to criticize this in articles that we wrote. We tried to criticize this on Twitter and on social media presence. And it was like hitting a brick wall, like nothing had any impact. Hmm. We were just told we didn't understand it. We were told, oh, you're white people or that you're Helen. But for Peter and I, that we were men, so we had no opinion on this. With Helen, that she wrote a very popular essay, I think in 2016 or 17, saying why I no longer call myself a feminist. Her hundreds of thousands of views and so much opprobrium that she on the internet that she wasn't prepared for, that it actually caused her, you know, severe disruptions to her life. And this obviously indicated that something in the world had changed and it had something to do with the scholarship. Then Peter and I, having recognized that, criticizing it and inviting people to conversations about it, which he had tried multiple times at Portland State University and did not succeed. Nobody would have a conversation about it with us. Hmm. Decided that we would write an academic hoax in the spirit of Alan Sokol, after having read a number of their papers and thought that this was just kind of mostly what you hear is the phrase now is word salad, but that's not correct. Mm. It was mostly that we thought they can't possibly know what they're really talking about, so let's write a hoax. We tried that and it sort of worked, but mostly didn't work, and was the conceptual penis as a social construct. So that got a lot of attention, but I think it really didn't achieve what we had believed it achieved at the time. And so then we ended up saying, well, all these people criticized it and they said, this is what we need to do to succeed. So let's do that. Hmm. And so we set out to do it properly, and we brought Helen in to help us because Helen understands the literature a little bit better than we did already. And she has a particular academic flair that doesn't quite match Peter's and my style. And so the three of us spent a year writing, well, 10 months actually, writing as many academic papers as we could write in that amount of time. Subjects like gender studies, feminism, ethnic studies, race theory, so on. And so queer theory, you know, to just go down the list.
Yeah.
Cat studies is another one. Sexuality studies, you can just go forever.
One of the papers I wrote about both the conceptual penis and then the criticism you received, I received that from my editorial piece about your conceptual penis article. And then about the grievance studies, and you had like one of my favorites was the fat bodybuilding one, just as muscles are a part of regular bodybuilding, then laying on fat should be considered like a competition as well, like in fat bodybuilding.
It can't be too competitive because that would exclude people. So it had to be a competition and not a competition at the same time, which doesn't make sense, except they thought it was fine. So, that was the kind of the tone and tenor of these papers. Is most of them were very silly. Some of them were quite serious with very bad ethics. So we ended up writing 20 of them, and 7 of them were accepted for publication, including fat bodybuilding. And 7 more were under review still when finally the Wall Street Journal caught us and got us in trouble and made it public before we were done. Mm. So that was the grievance studies affair. And what we think it showed is that you can, in fact, these academic journals to accept rather a lot of very bad argument and very bad ideas for the specific reason that the people that operate in those disciplines, if we might even be willing to call them disciplines, not very disciplined. But those people believe this stuff. They believe it and they think it's morally right. They think it's actually correct. Doesn't really matter to them. So it is the right way to think about the world. And so that me, knowing how we wrote our papers and what our ambitions were and the kinds of things we wrote, I think that it induced a crisis of faith where I, frankly, for my own part, I don't believe almost any research that has anything to do with the theory, a sociological theory or humanities-based theory of race, sex, gender, sexuality, or any of these kind of social identity categories at all anymore, because I don't know how to tell what has been done rigorously and what has not. I'm not a quantitative analysis kind of guy myself. I'm a mathematician, but I didn't learn, you know, how to rigorously vet a scientific statistical study. So I don't know how to tell what's valid and is invalid when it touches upon those subjects, unless I have the backing of other scientists who do know what they're talking about, saying, yes, these methods are rigorous. And as far as the theory goes, I don't believe any of it anymore.
So how did the grievance studies affair, how did that, because you've launched a site called New Discourses and you have a podcast together with that. And on New Discourses, you have a lot of articles about basically the same subjects as your forthcoming book, which you're writing together with Helen Pluckrose. I forgot to mention that. Probably some kind of power structure at work there.
That's right. Yeah, it's our sexism. Well, it's actually funny because Helen, before we even started the grievance studies affair, had already signed the book deal to work on the book that is now Cynical Theories. It was not at all clear what that book was going to be yet. She wanted to trace the postmodern literature from the 1960s going forward to the present day and show how it has been integral in shaping the way that what we called in the end social justice scholarship thinks about the world. The goal of this book, Cynical Theories, was to draw out the history and the ideas of how postmodern thought has shaped the modern social justice movement.
And how could you just like, because I read postmodernism, like postmodern theory when I read sociology at the university. And then later on, I read a lot of post-colonial literature, and but there is something like if you read Lyotard, Frederick Jameson, Foucault, Derrida, and there's What you paint, the picture you paint in Cynical Theories, is that something has changed from those early postmodernists to what we have today in critical theory. And could you just describe for the listeners what has changed? What was the first wave of postmodernism, and how has it changed?
Yes. So the first wave of postmodernism, and named the majority of the relevant scholars, although there are a few others, had a very kind of radically skeptical view of the world. In particular, they took up with the idea that knowledge is socially constructed and meaning is conveyed by language. But this is not only an imperfect tool for conveying meaning, is in fact a nearly useless tool for conveying meaning. So they had this very skeptical idea about knowledge. And ultimately, you know, if I had to summarize, well, what is postmodern theory, which is a very broad and sprawling idea or set of ideas that spans decades and many different thinkers who thought about things differently. But what is postmodern thought about? I would say that it is the belief that knowledge is socially constructed and therefore politics by other means.
Mm.
And so when you say politics, you have to ask what that means. What it means is that they believe that knowledge is, what we decide is going to be qualified as knowledge, is decided by a social process. So there are automatic political forces that influence who gets to decide something is knowledge and is not knowledge. So if you say, no, we use the scientific methodology, they say, well, somebody had to decide that methodology is rigorous. So that was a social and therefore political process as well, where some ideas were placed above others. And there was some process that was involved. And so the ultimate claim, kind of following mostly from Michel Foucault at this point, is that it's not really interesting to talk about whether these claims are true or false. It's more interesting to interrogate power and how the power shaped whether we, which ideas we authenticate, how we authenticate them, and why we've authenticated them. In particular, he was interested in two questions, which is, who does it serve to believe these things are true? That's a political question. And secondly, how do our beliefs about what's true and false constrain our ability to experience other ways of life or being? He called them potentialities.
Yeah,
of course. And so, so you have this idea of kind of breaking down all categories and freeing your mind into this abstract space. And that's sort of the basis of postmodern thought, that everything is sort of up for grabs and nothing means what it's supposed to mean, because somebody had to assert that it's supposed to mean that for it to take that meaning. So it's sort of this vicious attack on the stability of meaning as conveyed, especially in language, or as authenticated by claims to truth or knowledge. Then that is, I guess, all fun and games if what you want to do is play word games and pick things apart. But they went on to say that structured society, drawing off of the French structuralist tradition that they were deeply steeped in, and because they were also Marxists, that tied into Marx's ideas of the superstructures of society and how society is organized around those superstructures. So here they had moved the superstructure to language and culture rather than economics.
So there's a hegemony that you need to deconstruct, like a hegemony of thought or discourse. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Discourse actually is the right word. And so that's exactly what Foucault talked about. He said there were these truth regimes where you can think that there's like a period in history and location and geography. So a particular culture in time and space, that particular culture thinks in a certain way. And so it lives within a truth regime or an episteme that defines how they think, and thus what they can think and what they cannot think and what they think is unacceptable. It was sort of a description in some sense of the Overton window, taken to its full abstract expression. So this was all nihilistic and pessimistic and cynical and all of these kind of negative words you might attach to it. But it was ultimately, if you read their stuff, they thought they were playing. They refer to play constantly. So they thought they were being playful and just taking things apart and kind of being silly, and were sort of self-aware that they were being silly on certain levels. I mean, you can often see Foucault talking about the way power works if you watch any of his interviews or debates, and then he gets this kind of weird malevolent smile like Dr. Evil, like he knows he's screwing around with things on some level, and that's part of the point of postmodernism.
I always think about like the movie Matrix, like you one day like Foucault for example he just one day he woke up and like he thought that he saw how the world works, so he could defeat all the agents with his discourse theory.
I think it's actually, there's something to that. And as a matter of fact, one of the postmodern theorists we haven't named, Jean Baudrillard, from what I understand, The Matrix was supposed to be largely a film adaptation of his philosophy, but then he rejected that personally and said it didn't represent his philosophy correctly. So that is a very apt way to think about these things. So it all kind of changed in the 1990s. There was a second current of thought that was, you know, very radical and leftist that was also prominent over the last, I guess, century or so, which is the critical theory school of thought, which arose out of the failures of Marxism in the early 20th century and moved. This is where the concept of hegemony really came into the picture in the late 1920s. It later informed the postmodernists. So the critical school wants to identify where oppression exists in society as they understand oppression, which means not Marxism. And their goal is to identify who the oppressed classes are so that they can have their consciousness raised and want to have a revolution that overthrows free societies and liberalism. So they try to pick at the sore spots of society and engage in social activism to change the world in accordance with that view. They've been operating, like I said, since the 1920s. They had a big kind of moment before postmodernism really took off, the 1960s, and obviously very famous, you know, the May 1968 riots, the race riots in the United States of 1967 and 1968. Everybody references 1968. That was kind of the eruption point of critical theory into the mainstream, and it became very, very violent, almost like what we're seeing again today, and was eventually, it fell out of fashion and was kind of suppressed. It didn't disappear. It went underground. It went into a vein of kind of dissident scholarship within, that was actually allowed into the academies and kind of nurtured and cultured there, following the inclusion first of women's studies and then African-American studies in the United States and Australia particularly. These fields eventually turned into all of our famous studies fields like gender studies, African-American studies, ethnic studies, sexuality studies, and masculinity studies, and fat studies, and disability studies. And you can go on and on and on and on with the studies of literally everything. So the critical theory school kind of went underground and started to just become very academic. It stopped doing a lot of overt public social activism and people lost track of it. Then a group of, or a rash, I guess, of thinkers in a variety of different domains, and this is kind of the middle part of cynical theories is trying to explain this, started to pick up this very activist-driven mentality and adapt postmodern theory to it. So they mutated postmodern theory out of what its original high deconstructive phase that tore everything apart, kind of without any regard for what it was tearing apart, and then into this new, we're not going to tear apart oppression, anything can be torn apart, it will be maintained, and we're going to package this up for activism. And that's what we call applied postmodernism. Chapters 2 through 7 of Cynical Theories are dedicated to showing how the different veins of applied postmodernism came into being and how they think about the world.
And then one thing that's you're struck by when it comes to these theories is what you can call strategic relativism. Like you can deconstruct, you can use deconstructionism, you can use postmodernism and relativism against other categories, but your own category is the firm ground where you, is the hill you stand on, so to speak, so that you don't deconstruct.
Exactly right. So they took that oppressor versus oppressed power structure thinking of the critical theory school, and then took the postmodern deconstruction approach and discourse theory approach, and decided that the oppressed have been deconstructed enough, if you will, and they're not going to have to suffer more of it. So those who qualify as oppressed by this liberation theory, radical liberationism theory, would not be subjected to deconstruction. But everything that that theory says is an oppressor that has systemic power attached to it gets to be deconstructed, and in fact must be deconstructed very vigorously. So this is why you see claims like that racism can only point in one direction, that it's prejudice plus systemic power. These definitions that have imported the idea of systemic power are exactly what you're talking about, this sort of strategic one-directional postmodernism or strategic deconstruction of only that which they have deemed has power. And if you'll notice, they've cooked the books such that they can never be the ones who have power, so they can continue to do this even now, where they're throwing people out of their jobs and justifying burning down buildings and all kinds of mayhem in their name.
Yeah, and I recently wrote a book called Genusdoktrinen, or the Gender Doctrine, because a lot of this that is happening in the United States and is happening in Sweden, but here race isn't the big question, or not the strongest of the identity politics issues. Here it's gender. So many of those things that you describe in the book, for example, and what's happening now, there was, for example, in Seattle, they had a course just for white employees that where they were taught like things that individualism, meritocracy, rationality, stuff like that were parts of white supremacy. And in Sweden, we have those same courses, but here you're shown that excellence in science, objectivity, words like that are part of the patriarchy. So it's basically the same theory. But one thing that really strikes home is that there is no room for disagreement with these theories. So if you are part of the oppressor class, you are basically, when you describe Robin DiAngelo's theory of white fragility, this point is very obvious. Like, if you're presented with the case that you're white, so you should own up to your privilege, you stand your ground and admit that you're a racist and you're part of a racist structure. And if you don't do that, then you're fragile and you're denying it. So there's no room for disagreement. And I would just like if you could elaborate on why is there a way to disagree with these people without being part of the problem? What's your view?
No, there's no way to disagree with these people without being part of the problem they try to describe, which means what they're describing is baloney. But I don't know if you have baloney in Sweden, but it's...
It's a bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, you probably have some kind of a fermented fish or something that's roughly the same.
Yes, 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 we do.
So, jokes aside about your lovely country that I need to visit someday. I do need to get to Sweden sometime. I have friends there.
Yeah, you should really visit. It's lovely, and we have a lot of corona, so you'll probably die, but it's lovely.
Oh, we've got the monopoly on corona right now.
Here,
so don't worry. We have plenty of corona as well. We can bond yes. over death, over the plague. No, there is no disagreement. The theory actually operates off of a view of false consciousness. So there are two sides to false consciousness. One is internalized dominance, and one is internalized oppression. This, of course, goes back to Karl Marx, although he didn't really talk about false consciousness himself too much. His followers did. Engels, I guess, talked about it a little bit, but Marx only very little. I think he mentioned it twice is it. And it wasn't a major concept of his. By the time the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory was rolling, it was a major concept of understanding. And the idea is that the unwashed masses don't know what's best for them. And those who are oppressed in particular don't have awareness of their oppression. They have internalized their oppression as the right and natural thing. And it's believed that the elite classes, the bourgeoisie, if it's Marxism, but the societal elites, those with systemic power, hate the norms and the narratives of society that convince people that it's normal and natural that things are the way they are. So the way this is theorized to work. That's the internalized oppression that the oppressed believe they've taken, that these things are normal and natural and just have to be accepted. So they've internalized their oppression. Internalized dominance is a little bit more complicated and kind of much more important to the theory, and nobody ever talks about it. The internalized dominance idea is that people who hold dominant positions in society, so for Sweden, it would definitely be the men, they have the privilege of not needing to be aware of the fact that they are not the only thing in society. So they see themselves as default. They see it as natural that they are the default. And they have a large number of psychological mechanisms that literally the Frankfurt School pulled from Freudian psychoanalysis, like this case, prevent them from being able to see that they are complicit in these systems of dominance, that the systems of dominance are literally invisible to them. So because
that's why you need to wake up and be woke, isn't it?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's called a critical consciousness. If you go back to the Harry, who was a Marxist and wanted to install Marxism as a liberatory education program in Brazil, and my Brazilian friends say he ruined Brazilian education by doing so. That's the idea, is that.
You sure he wasn't in Sweden? Because I think it's something similar happened here, but we have our own Marxists. So
happened after him, actually, starting in the late 1970s, it started to spread everywhere. The critical education they could get a hold of, which is most of them in the kind of advanced democracy world, maybe not including Japan, Korea. You have this internalized dominance or internalized oppression, so that if you disagree, the theory says, well, that's just because you have internalized the power structures of society, and therefore your disagreement is not legitimate. You literally have several of you have read in Cynical Theories where we document several examples of this. Throughout their literature, you have a sustained case that to read their scholarship and disagree with it, to take one of the classes that they teach and not come away with the exact same conclusions as the teacher, is that you failed to properly understand it, which is a very religious way of thinking about material, that the only way that you can show that you understood it is by completely agreeing with it in the end. So this is...
You had like on the Swedish part of Twitter, you had like a few years ago, you had an expression that was very popular when you disagreed. It's like, get an analysis. And you just got that thrown back at you if you disagreed. So an analysis, singular, an analysis, which is really what this is about. Like there is a proper way to understand this. And if you analyze it, you will reach this conclusion. And that conclusion is not the one you just said, because you're now part of the problem.
Right. Now, this is a very interesting thing, because you can see that this is an attempt to copy science and to do so badly, because the premise of science, of course, with science, you can disagree. I don't want to make that misimpression. The point with science is that the ultimate decider is the experiment. Therefore, you just have to get in line with what reality says, and you have to just submit to whatever reality tells you. And the way we find out what reality tells us is by doing the experiment, just kind of asking the question of nature. This, however, is a theoretical construct that says that you just have to submit to the theory. And pretty much every time that's come up in history, it's worked out to be a bad idea. Theory is not actually reality. It is the thoughts of people who will, like all people, make mistakes or kind of get their carts before their horses and so on. So this is a bad mimicry of what they believe in their lack of understanding how science proceeds, that there's some ultimate arbiter of what is correct and incorrect, and that we can defer to it. For them, it is their own theory. It tells you how the world works. And if you disagree, it's because you have a psychological problem preventing you from being able to understand it properly. Whereas in science, it's if you disagree, if I drop an apple from my roof and it falls to the ground and I disagree, I say, no, it doesn't fall to the ground. I mean, that's just silly. It doesn't mean anything because the world is the world. Theory, however, is not the same as the world. So you can see that's confusing, but it's a mimicry, a bad mimicry of how science works. In other words, this is why they think they have the truth, and they proceed that way.
And it's also what you write in Cynical Theories is you also bring up certain academics who have there's something called epistemic injustice, epistemic violence. Like if you, it's even you have an example. I forget who it was, but in a classroom situation, if a student asks a question or doesn't agree with a certain way, it's racism, for example, is explained, then that's actually not like a disagreement, a constructive disagreement, where you get a chance to argue with that person and present better arguments. It's harmful.
Yeah, that's a big theme in the literature. I think the example in the book is drawing from Alison Bailey's idea of privilege preserving epistemic pushback in the generation of shadow texts. Her case is that if the student raises such a point, indeed, that what they're trying to do is preserve their privilege by derailing that's actually the phrase that they use, derailing the classroom conversation, which in other words means the lecture that the teacher is trying to indoctrinate them with. Disagreement is not allowed to be brokered. Discussion is also not, because discussion would imply that there could be disagreement. So discussion around their points is not to be brokered. You can only allow, listen, and accept. It's really the only thing that they allow. It's not what people think it is. It's not a analytical tool or exploration, open-minded exploration of the issues of identity. It's a group of a small group of scholars that has now become quite powerful and has a lot of support that believe that they have the only possible truth about these issues that everybody now needs to listen to. And if they don't, it's their hidden bigotry that prevents them from being able to, I mean, it's literally they mind read and say it must be your most cynical motivation possible that's keeping you from agreeing, which is why we call it cynical theories, by the way. It's always getting the most cynical motivation possible into every situation.
Yeah, and one thing that I like, it's that's one that's really awful, but it's also that what I take away also from your excellent book is that cancel culture is really a logical outgrowth of this, because it's not only that some people have refused to come to terms with their inherent bigotry or inherent privilege. It's also that they are harming other people just by saying the stuff that they are saying, because they are reinforcing the dominant power structures that these theorists want to deconstruct and fight against. So you have to cancel and deplatform these people, because it's a matter of life and death. At least that's how they talk about it.
That's right. You could go deeply back into the theory and see that you are correct. Cancel culture is a logical outgrowth, is the logical conclusion. It is a necessary conclusion of adopting this way of thinking. That's because they believe that the power structures operate not from some, you know, cabal of people in the government or something like this. They operate through every individual in terms of what that individual believes, thinks, and how that person speaks. The people who have the wrong beliefs or people who make the wrong speech, which reveals that they have the wrong beliefs, are upholding that power structure, and they believe that that power structure, they basically cherry pick every bad thing that happens and turn it into this monstrous error that is the so-called realities of having an oppressed identity. So it's, you know, in the United States now, despite the fact that last year we had 9 unarmed Black people shot by police, it's, you know, the police are murdering us in the street every day, which isn't even mathematically possible. And you get these kind of very tearful explanations, especially with the gender issue. You get the very tearful explanations about how everybody is constantly being excluded or not given opportunities, constantly subjected to sexual assault. And sexual assault, of course, is then blurred out to be, you know, some to include, say, the male gaze. So, you know, you go to a shop and a man looks at a woman a little too long, and maybe it's just that he's trying to figure out why she has a bit of cracker on her jacket, but she doesn't know it's there. that gets interpreted as the male gaze, that he's leering at her and wants to have sex with her, but wanting to have sex with her is tantamount to raping her. So she's now experienced a sexual assault, and they experience sexual assault every day, all day. So you have this kind of catastrophizing exaggeration of the bad things that do really happen, and turning very normal things that happen to people into manifestations of that. So even when you mentioned the idea of epistemic violence, the idea of not agreeing with somebody who is of an oppressed class can be categorized as a form of violence because you didn't properly believe them, or you didn't think that they were credible enough. So a person could literally just be wrong, and you know that they're wrong. They could be saying something as wrong as 2 + 2 = 5. You could say, no, that's incorrect. And if they happen to be somebody in one of these so-called oppressed groups, they could say, well, you just don't think I'm a credible person because of who I am, because I'm a woman, or because I'm gay, or because I'm black. You don't think I'm a credible person. And that's a form of violence, according to this theory.
You have a very, in one of your podcasts, you develop a theory or a framework on how to understand these theories and how they what the strategy is in a debate, and you call that the Mott and Bailey. And I think that's really fruitful, because just today I read a very reasonable editorial in another paper about how identity politics is not at all in conflict with Enlightenment values, because all they're trying to achieve is equality for all, like all lives matter. And so what Black Lives Matter want to do is that they want black lives to be equal with white people. And what Me Too wanted is to, the Me Too movement wanted was for women to be equal with men. And with your framework, with the Mott and Bailey, I think it's a prime example of a person who defends the Mott for these people and ignores the Bailey. But could you like explain to people what the Mott and Bailey strategy is?
Yeah, so the Mott and Bailey was actually, as far as I understand, was named by a philosopher named Nicholas Shackle in 2005, who was talking about the rhetorical strategies used by postmodern thought. And this really is a postmodern thing, because like we discussed before, they felt like they were playing. Discourse and language were the site where meaning is constructed. They had to play to deconstruct language. One of the favorite tricks of postmodern thinking is to use double meanings and puns. So you mean two things by a word at the same time, and if you're really clever, you can mean both of them at the same time, get away with some kind of a linguistic joke, which is why it's borderline impossible to understand Derrida, because he did this constantly. And in fact, it is literally impossible to translate Derrida out of French, because if you don't understand the puns in French, there's not even translations for the puns in French. So it's this whole word game kind of stupidity. But if you end up taking this and packaging it up for activists in a very strategic way, you can use this double meaning game to mean two things by the same phrase. So you can advance a very radical agenda by meaning one thing with a word or a phrase, and you can then have a very easily defended idea you were just describing, so that worked out as a good example, by having a very defensible, simple, different understanding of the phrase. So it's a double meaning game. The Mott and Bailey actually refers to a form of castle construction. A bailey is a kind of wide sweeping field, good farmland, good place to have a village. They have a wall or a moat around it. Usually it's built adjacent to a hill or a mountain, and then on top of that raised area, the mountainside or the hill, will have a tower that's easily defended, very, very defensible tower. The idea would be that you have maybe roughly, you know, a square kilometer in which people can live and work and have a nice life in their farms and their houses. Then with this castle, that if somebody comes to take over their property, they can retreat and hide in the castle and throw rocks and shoot arrows and chase them away. Eventually, the besieging army gets sick of being hit with arrows and rocks, so they leave, and you can come back down. That's the Mott, and you can come back down out of the Mott into that field, which is called the Bailey, and reoccupy the territory. Rhetorically, what it is that your very safe, defensible position. Oh, well, the Black Lives Matter just wants to point out that Black lives need to matter equally, and then that would mean all lives matter, and that's a very equality-based, Enlightenment principles, liberal view, and so it's just that's the Mott. almost impossible to disagree with that when you listen to it. But the trick is you almost always can tell these are happening because of the word just gets stuck in there. Oh, Black Lives Matter just means that people, you know, should all be treated equally and Black lives need to be treated equally too. No, it doesn't just mean that. It means something else too. And so what happens is when they say something very radical about Black Lives Matter and then they get criticized for it, say in the press or even in the moment on an interview or in person, they can say, oh, no, it's just this other very simple thing that nobody would disagree with. And then the moment you say, oh, okay, well, if it's just that, then fine. And they go back to the radical position.
So one of them is when they started saying abolish the police. And I remember I wrote on Twitter, like, abolish the police. So that'll probably work out terrible for black communities in the United States because there's a lot of black people getting killed in black communities. And then I was very heavily criticized because no, what they're saying is that they want more money to social welfare and that they want less militarization of the police forces. No, they were actually saying that they wanted to abolish the police. That's the actual thing that they were saying. No, but what you see is that there's so it wasn't what they were saying, but somebody else came in and defended, so to speak, their mot for them against me. It's the same with if you take Greta Thunberg, the most famous Swede of all time nowadays. Her rallying cry was, listen to the scientists, listen to the science. So that's her mot. And then she says all kinds of other stuff that's really crazy. And then you criticize her for that. And then you get, not by her, but by her, a lot of well-meaning people, intelligent people, they are telling you that, no, but what she's saying is that you should just listen to the scientists. How can you be against that? And then you have to, like, the strategy works most of the time. Like, people have to retreat, like, okay, let's listen to the silence. And then the madness, so to speak, continues.
Right. So this is a very postmodern way to argue and a very postmodern way to advance a political agenda. And the podcast you referenced that I did about this topic, that what you actually have to do, because this, you can't put this genie back in the bottle. People are misusing language very intentionally to do this. When they said abolish the police, they knew what they meant. And everybody knows they knew what they meant, except the people who are willing to give them far too much credit. What you actually have to do is you have to do both sides of the argument for the person. So you have to become very informed and know both sides and say both sides. In other words, have to, what I said, is steal their mot. You have to go take their castle from them first. If I was going to go take over a mot and bailey area, I wouldn't go attack the bailey if I could. I would sneak in and fill the mot and then throw rocks at them until they go away. So that's actually the strategy that you have to fight back against this stuff. It's very difficult when something's being said in, you know, the national media or international media, and you're just stuck with what was said. What you have to be able to do is say, okay, here is the reasonable thing, and here is why it's reasonable and why everybody agrees. And here is the other thing that is also being said. And you can see both of them at the same time. Let's look at both of them at the same time. And ideally, you would even then point out and say, this is why the people playing this game with you are cheating you. This is how they are trying to deceive you. And we need to be much more careful about who we decide to listen to. And when we detect this kind of behavior, this rhetorical behavior, need to become very suspicious. It's very much like teaching people that they should look both ways before they cross the street, as a car might hit you. In this case, it's somebody done this rhetorical strategy. We live in a very information-based age where much of everything is happening in text and writing and speaking, and it's all very much language. We need similar rules. Are you being taken to the cleaners by somebody who's using a rhetorical trick on you like the Mott and Bailey? So you need to look both ways and see, is that what's happening? And when it is, you know, if there was a car coming, you wouldn't step out into the street. And when you see the Mott and Bailey, you wouldn't step into believing that what that person is trying to advance. So developing skills like this, I think, is going to be necessary in our current information era.
One thing that I find, and you, it was one of the first things you said in the interview. Now that's like, if you even about the subtitle, how how activist scholarship made everything about race, gender, identity, and why this harms everybody. And like, if you go into this minefield, you will be labeled different things. You will, the generosity principle is never applied to you when it comes to this. And so what you're saying with the Mott and Bailey is that you should not stoop to their level, so to speak, because you have to defend the Mott because that's worth defending. But like, one instinct you get, and I think a lot of people get, is that when you're labeled evil, racist, misogynist, often enough, you start to people get sick and tired of it, and they want revenge. They don't just want to be sensible. So that's one of the dangers with all this, I think. And like, how this is not really a question, this is just a fear I have. Like, people, instead of deconstructing the critical race studies, they become more invested in their white identity, for example.
Actually see that happening, and I'm scared of it. It's one of the things Helen and I have been talking publicly about it at least since the middle of last year, maybe earlier than that. And I know we alluded to it before that. We're very concerned that this sort of critical race obsession will force many people into a position where they just accept, okay, if you're going to say all white people are racist, I'll be racist. And so what I keep having happen to me on Twitter, for example, is people who, I'll put out some tweet about something to do with this critical race stuff, and then they'll say, this isn't good enough. We need to assert our white culture and say this is good. And then I always say no if I see it. I usually don't see much on Twitter anymore, but if I see it, I say no, that's not what we do. Identity politics is bad no matter what the identity is. They say things back like, well, they force identity politics on all of us, so we're going to play it to win. That's when I start to get scared. But every time I fight back against that, I get a vicious round of nasty, nasty messages. So it's impossible to wade into this minefield, but I'm just going to say it and then I'll explain it afterwards. The people pushing these theories think they can control the dragon that they're breeding, and they cannot control it. The backlash is going to come. It's going to be hopefully as small as possible, because most people will remain reasonable and not want to do that. They are not fooling with people who are going to remain reasonable forever. And a lot of them aren't reasonable in the first place. And they're going to become very angry and very aggrieved. They're going to wake up sleeping giant that should not wake up, and that nobody wants to have wake up. And I say I have to qualify this, because theory, that it, as you just said, it never gives the principle of generosity or charity to you. It always reads your motivation cynically. Say that because these people were always horrible white supremacists and racists. It's not possible that we push them over the edge because we're against racism and white supremacy. So they were always that. And we predicted all along that their backlash would come as a means to try to reassert white dominance, blah, blah, blah. And so they're going to use that they're provoking people to bad behavior that they then constantly have warned. The bad behavior is just under the surface. So then they'll claim that as proof in a victory. You see this happening actually over and over and over again already with various media stories, where you see people get provoked into some kind of behavior. And then they say, aha, look, it happened a lot with us following the grievance studies affair, for example, where we got invited to talk to very, very few entities that would be labeled as left-wing. We got invited to obscene amounts of right-wing outlets. So if we wanted to tell anybody about what we did, in the media, we had to talk to right-wing sources. We had to talk mostly to right-wing sources, because left-wing sources, first of all, wouldn't reach out. And then second of all, for the most part, then twist our words and write some nasty piece trashing us. So it became this thing that we were only talking to right-wing media. And so the next thing that happened was they were like, aha, there were tools for the right all along. They're actually right-wing conservatives. That was the real point, was to do stuff for conservatives and conservative this, conservative that. But they manifested the thing into the world and then used it as evidence for the crap they believe in the first place. And there's something, you know, people have to actually start to see that this is a, you know, age-old political strategy. The fact that we're getting taken for a ride by it seems every other day now is just absolutely absurd.
So one thing is I wanted to ask you about is, first I want to tell you, I wrote a book called The Gender Doctrine, as I said, together with a scholar named Anna-Karin Windham, and she actually worked at one of the institutions that has been what was responsible for gender mainstreaming all Swedish universities and science boards, like funding science. So she's one of the insiders and like a dropout. So she describes from the inside how they their frame of mind and how they work. And we had a lot of cases, and we interviewed up to 100 academics, both sides of the argument. And then we have a lot of we name them, and we have like 500 or 450 references and everything. So we thought that when this book is published, we're going to have a debate. And we've been very successful with the sales, and we've had a lot of papers write about the book. We've been on TV, we've been on the radio, but there's been no debate. Nobody is coming out to debate us.
Hold your breath.
They're talking, yes. And people, a lot of people are saying, oh, congratulations to the success with the book. And it's, and of course I'm happy about that. But what I'm very concerned about is that there's actually no way to break into the hegemony, so to speak. So I was wondering, with that is one of, like, a very fresh experience for me that I'm planning to write about this just now. But I was wondering what your experience with grievance studies, and I mean, you've been very active for longer than that, but also with the forthcoming book, like, what is your experience with, have you had any fruitful discussions with people on the other side? Have they answered you has anybody answered you in a constructive way? Are you hopeful at all about this?
No, not really. I don't want to be unfair to a rather dedicated contingent of relatively small figures who mostly reach out to us on Twitter, but they have on other platforms as well. Tried to engage us in what seems to be, I don't want to call it bad faith debate. It's more like not good or bad. It's like tipped slightly bad, but trying to be good or something like that. It's very odd. For the most part, no. And certainly no scholars have engaged with it in a substantive way, or are likely to engage with it in a substantive way at all. And we've talked about the reasons. The book will be seen as upholding oppressive discourses. And the problem, one of their problems, because they think everything is subconsciously mediated in terms of consciousness and false consciousness and internalized consciousness, is that exposing yourself or associating yourself with the wrong discourses absolutely infects you. I saw, for example, I know it's just some person random on Twitter, but it's indicative of the mindset, which is that they said, if you have 10 people at a table plus one Nazi, you have 11 Nazis at the table. And so even if those 10 other people possibly, I mean, in as it's phrased, even if those 10 people are literally the judge and jury, they're going to put the Nazi in prison, still that association is absolutely unacceptable. So because guilt by association with the wrong discourses and the producers of the wrong discourses is seen as utterly contaminating, won't find them engaging with that material. And instead, all we've had are accusations that were stupid, or accusations that we couldn't possibly have understood it, or accusations that we have the wrong sex or gender. Having Helen being a woman helps a little bit with that. If I had written it, it would just be, oh, straight white man writes a book to maintain his privilege. That would have been the end of that.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't have a lot of hope for any good faith debate. I don't feel like I actually feel like this thing is a cult. And I mean that in the most sincere terms. And it is not possible to break in a cult and debate with the cult, because that would tear apart the entire point of the cult. So I don't know how you resolve this problem when the cult has taken over so much of our institutional infrastructure of our societies. But I do know that it's a major problem.
Yeah, and I think what you described there is if a Nazi sits down with 10 people, that's 11 Nazis. That's actually like a school book religion for you. I mean, like the rituals you have to go through to rid yourself of taint. If you've been in, for example, in India with the caste system, if you're dirty and you've been in contact with one of the casteless, you have rituals that you have to go through to cleanse yourself of the taint. And there is something similar at work with these kinds of things, like you have to get rid of the taint. So you have to go through sort of speech rituals, and you have to go through certain behaviors to convince people that you're free of this taint, of this this Nazi taint or this racism or what will you. I think you're right. It's a cult, and it's not like a cult. It's an actual cult.
Right. So I'll give you an example of something from their literature. This is not a mainstream concept, but it does appear. I have not seen it used to big effect yet, but I figure it's only a matter of time now. I've seen it used in small cases. There's a concept that they have called non-consensual co-platforming. So non-consensual co-platforming would occur. Let's say that a gender scholar were to write an article for a prominent newspaper. Then say you were a month later invited to write a column for the same newspaper. Gender scholar could complain and try to get your article retracted or unpublished, or to accuse the newspaper of patriarchy or sexism or misogyny by co-platforming you and her in the same publication without her consent. So you have now your taint onto her, even though there's no logical way that could have happened, by the willingness of the editor to have accepted material from both sources. You know, the logic behind it, it's very difficult to explain the logic for this, that they would have in their head is, my name is now associated with that newspaper, and this person who wrote the gender doctrine's name is also associated with that newspaper. So I might run into a situation now where I say, oh yeah, I had this article in the newspaper, and then the person might reply, isn't that the same newspaper that published that sexist? And so now they're sexist by implication. So they call this non-consensual co-platforming. So they've literally theorized about this, and eventually that tool will be put into significant use. I'm waiting. It's only a matter of time before certain people won't be allowed to publish anything in the New York Times, not because they disagree with the content, but because the person themselves can't be associated with other people who have been published in the New York Times.
So I know you're busy, so I'm not going to take up much more of your time, but I just wanted to, how come there's not more of you out there? I mean, James Lindsay and your Helen Pluckrose and Peter Boghossian, I mean, because, how you describe in the introduction to your book, if you visit a foreign country, you need an interpreter and you need a guide, and you are interpreters and guides for us into critical theory. And so what I found is that I wrote a book, How We All Became Racist, together with Adam Sveiman, and that's what we thought we would do, because what we found was that people who are liberal, they were so uninterested in all this. And it's the same now with the gender doctrine. It's not that people don't think it's a problem, but they're not like, when they have like an evening off, they're not going to read these books. So there are very few of you, of you guys and writing about this. And this is a really big problem, I would say. How many, how can you clone people? How can you sign on to, I mean, the other guys, they have really good names for their movements as well. They have social justice, that's great. Anti-racism, that's also great. I mean, they have a great name, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. It's great movements, and it's very easy to catch on and you understand, but it's just, it feels like sort of, I'm not sure if this, I hope I'm wrong, but it feels like a skewed playing field. There should be more.
It's very skewed. And so there are a number of reasons why there are so few of us. One is what you touched on. I even wrote an essay for Quillette a couple of years ago about that. is that nobody seems to find this stuff interesting, which is a problem. Liberals don't find these subjects interesting. I keep finding people sending me messages now that are saying, I'm actually to the point now where I've had to think about identity stuff more than I've ever had to think about it in my life. And these don't just mean white people or men. These include actually black people, black women, as a matter of fact. And they're saying that they've been forced to think about race or sex or gender or whatever more than they ever have in their lives over the past 2 months. They're sick of it. They don't want to think about these things. The whole point of liberal society was to get away from having to think about these things and to move on with life and do things that people enjoy rather than doing this divisive, stressful, uncomfortable stuff that in this case seems to be driving wedges between people rather than bringing them together or making anybody happy. So there's a disinterest in studying it at all. Then there's the academic barrier. Stuff is actually very academic. The language is academic. The theories are complicated. If you want to go back and read the original French postmodernists, they're extremely hard to read. But Foucault is okay, but hard. But Derrida is literally impossible. This isn't literally like figuratively. This is literally impossible to read. If you look even at the newer theorists, Judith Butler, almost impossible to read. It's not fun reading. It's hard reading. It's nonsense. I remember talking to several different scholars who said they just can't make their brains function in nonsense. They've worked so hard to train themselves to think in sense that they can't think in nonsense. So they find reading these things to be painful. I get emails almost every day from people trying to read White Fragility asking me, how on earth do you do this? I have to read a couple of paragraphs at a time and then stop for a day. Because it's so infuriating.
I had that experience when I researched, like I read everything Sarah Ahmed wrote about, because we had a movement here in Sweden a couple of years ago that was very separatist, and it was about racification was a big word here in Sweden, like a social process of race, like becoming a race through the oppressor class view of you. So I read all that and I was like, I was so infuriated. I was like, I became a bad husband. I had to go out to go for runs all the time. I was so frustrated all the time. I just wanted to scream. And I heard you say on Joe Rogan that like your right eyelid, I think, got a twitch for half a year. So you get physical symptoms. That's, wouldn't you call that epistemic violence against you?
Yeah. Somebody should pay me for my emotional labor. I had to read it the same way. I had to read it a few pages at a time at first, and kind of people keep asking me, how do you do it? And I say, you get used to it. It's like dipping yourself in very hot water or something. Eventually you get used to it. It's very unpleasant though. And so I don't think a lot of people are interested. And then the academic language is its own barrier. Then the nonsense is its own barrier. And very, very few people, two aspects of this, very few people are interested in studying things that they don't agree with. So Helen and I are notable exceptions that we decided it would be interesting to figure out how these people think and to tinker around with their ideas and understand how did they get to these absurd conclusions. But very few people have the patience or interest to do that. Secondly, since you almost need academic people to be able to read it in the first place, it bears pointing out that there's almost no academic incentive to look at this stuff at all. Will not get a paper. So if you're an engineer, you're not going to get a paper in engineering. You're not going to get a paper in the sciences. Nothing that advances your career by reading some of this stuff and criticizing it. There's nothing there for you. It doesn't, even if it's a biology, it doesn't help you to go criticize stuff that all the other biologists just think is silly nonsense. And so there's no career advancement involved. There's no money in it. There's no support structure. And then there's the possibility that you're going to get brought up on charges by your university. There's the possibility that your colleagues are going to start thinking badly of you, that you must have these terrible motivations that theory says you have. You will be accused of these things for certain. And so the incentives literally point all in the opposite direction. There are no incentives for people to look at it. So, of course, what is the answer to that? Create incentives for people to look at it. Prestigious academic awards for debunking this crap. That would go a long way. Prestigious academic endowed chairs for people that, you know, alumni donors or whatever out there who set up endowed chairs for people who are recognized for cleaning up scholarship. And I'm not saying this for myself. I don't want an endowed chair. I don't want to go back to the university. So even if somebody offered me one, I don't want it. So this isn't some self satisfying grifter plea, but this would motivate if there were if there were some set of incentives. Like, hey, okay, so here's an actual example.
Yeah.
You got invited to a university in Germany last spring as a result of the grievance studies in Dresden. We went there and they named us heroes of science and let us do a talk at one of their conferences, which turned out to be extremely controversial and got people kind of excited and also other people yelling at us. But it went well enough. But they named us heroes of science, where if something like that meant something for your career as an academic, if there were incentives to taking this stuff on that that meant something in terms of, you know, professional career advancement within your department, possibly endowed chairs, recognition, book deals, so on and so forth, where there's some incentive structure to motivate people who have the capability and to criticize this stuff deeply, do so, that would change it. Because right now, the only people who have an incentive structure to look into it are people who believe it. And so that's the only people who look into it. It's not pleasant work. Like you talked about my twitching eyelid. You talked about your own frustration to the point where it was, you know, you've become this horrible husband and have to go out running and want to scream your fist in your pocket because you're a Swede. I told you, I have Swedish friends. I know your ways.
What? Yes, but I think that's one of my character flaws is that I have a very hard time doing it in my pocket. So that's why I get into trouble so much.
Oh, I see. You're one of those. Yeah. Okay, one
yes,
of those Swedes.
Yes, yes.
You got your Finnish blood, I see.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I should let you go now, but you have, there are ways around this, like your new website that I really recommend to our listeners is called New Discourses, and you can become a Patreon, and you can actually fund these kinds of this work that you do. And that's how I funded my book. I got people, interested people, 1,400 people who paid for to made it possible. So there are some things that you can do, and you can also go out and buy Cynical Theories by James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose, which will come out on the 25th of August. So I just want to thank you very much, James, for taking your time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. You know, drag you through the madness a little bit.
Och tack till alla er som har lyssnat. Och om ni har några synpunkter eller frågor så får ni gärna höra av er på ledarsidan @svd.se. Tack och hej!